or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
After working in businesses from Sunshine Health Food to American Express, Eric Weissman decided he was tired of the corporate BS. For example, he told me about being forced to watch and then implement training videos that try to, quote, turn us into robots, end quote. So he started Jaunty.org, Jaunty.org, to help people improve their social skills in a real way. We've all heard of engine nerds who struggle with that sort of thing, but the fact is most of us could use a boost, whether to be more assertive or less, or to know how to negotiate that business party, the holiday party that's coming up that's a minefield, or how to ask for a raise in the coming year. There's a lot of anxiety that can be rife in such situations, especially likely in today's digital age. Many people will feel more comfortable interacting on LinkedIn and Facebook. And yet, as Eric Weissman says, sometimes a little well-done in-person interaction can be 10 times as effective as a Facebook update. So, Eric Weissman, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Marty.
Now, did I pronounce your name right, first of all?
Yeah, I saw you put a Y in there. And
no, I. It's good.
It was an I. Yeah. Well, I guess when we came over to Ellis Island, they didn't know how to spell it, so they improvised with an AI.
Yeah, but because we're on the radio, the spelling don't mean crap. It's Weissman. It is Weissman.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right. Now, you've got this little staff of yours at this jaunty.org, and you try to improve people's social skills in a number of areas, and one is body language. And you say it's wiser to focus on recognizing your own body language than in reading others. Explain that, maybe with an example.
Yeah, so I think the first and foremost thing you should focus on is how we're feeling and what we're doing. And one of the biggest things we always say is slow down. And I think it's important to focus on yourself first, because some people say to mirror others or to read others, but how you act translates into how you feel. And so you can start anchoring feeling good with acting opened and relaxed, with feeling opened and relaxed.
That's what you call fake it till you make it. You may be feeling anxious, but if you can somehow control your physiology, and you're a laid-back guy, so it's not hard for you, but for people who are nervous by nature, somehow controlling it as well you can behaviorally, and that somehow will change your attitude. Is that your point?
Yeah, it might actually turn into a pattern where if you, for a few weeks or a few months, consciously act open and relaxed, remind yourself that that is feeling open and relaxed. The days you wake up and you're totally stressed out, you can do the opposite and start acting open and relaxed even when you're stressed out, and your brain will say, hey, you know what, I'm kind of doing the calm and relaxed body language, so maybe I should start, you know, dropping a little endorphins and slowing down, taking some stress out of my system.
So this is like deep breath stuff. Does that help? Are you into the meditation approach to calming down? What's your take on all that stuff? Mindfulness?
Yes, I think mindfulness is huge. I do a little bit of meditation. I would love to do yoga, but that's not something I got into. I think just slowing down is one of the big ones.
If I had to lay a prediction, that I think the mindfulness, be in the moment, yoga thing is going to go away. I think it's a fad. I know it's existed for thousands of years, but I have seen it like the tipping point. It like reached a peak in around 2012, stayed fairly high, and then there's this really famous professor, Adam Grant, from the University of Pennsylvania, who wrote Mindfulness is Mindlessness, and I don't know if it, I think it was in The Atlantic or something like that, and really took a step back from our, you know, we all tend to jump on the latest bandwagon to finding peace, nirvana, and joy and success. And he's saying that, of course, it makes sense to pay attention when you're doing something, be in the moment for that moment. But beyond that, we've made a big deal. And most times people who are meditating are just going to sleep, taking a nap, and the serious meditators who go on retreats for, you know, 9 days, Vipassana retreats and the rest of it, you know, they don't come back transformed in any way. But I welcome your pushing back on that. That's what he basically says.
Yeah, I think you're right that some people jump on it as a bandwagon. However, there's so much stimulus going on in our world, and we're getting pulled in so many directions. We're trying to keep up online and offline that I think if we don't take a step back, pay attention to what our bodies are telling us in some form, we'll go insane. I think there's just too much going on that can stress us out. And I think asking your body, hey, what do you need now, whether it's rest, whether it's alone time, whether it's love, loving yourself, whatever it is, I think that's never going to hurt. So,
you know, they say it, every hammer, everything is a nail. I'm a career counselor. To me, the answer is in putting yourself in environments of work that don't stress you out. If you are doing what you're, you know, naturally good at and or well trained to do, you're not stressed. Like, I do love my career counseling practice. I love it. And I think if they hooked up a monitor to my blood pressure and cortisol release level and whatever,
wow,
I would bet that I am more relaxed counseling a client than doing most other things. So for as a career counselor, I would argue that the key to relaxing is not breathing, meditating, reminding yourself to slow down. It's putting yourself in an environment where you don't need to slow down, where you are grounded, where you are who you were meant to be, to use a more progressive term. Your thoughts?
Yeah, totally. I think we're all naturally adept to doing certain things. There is the whole, you know, there's a big thing of saying, do what you love, do what you love. I'd like to flip it and say, you know, love what you do.
Right.
I agree with that. Yeah. And I think you can find the best things, just like, you know, whether it's conversation, whether it's engaging with people, whether it's work, whether it's your relationship, you can find your favorites and the things you love in that and kind of gear toward that. I think, and you can discover that. It's a discovery process along the way. I think it's something that you actually say in your courses is, hey, you might not know what you love until you try it. And then once you start trying it, you realize you love it, and a certain part of the innate skill set comes out naturally. So
those who are regular listeners to the show know that I often say doing what you love is often very, 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 very risky, especially in the Bay Area, because we do have a special degree of groupthink here. And so the things that we love here tend to be loved by many people. We love the environment. We do love spirituality. We do love multiculturalism. We love certain things. Some segments of the population love sports. Some love fashion. There's a relatively small percentage of the world's activities that we tend to love. And so if you do what you love for a living, supply and demand means you're going to starve unless you are lucky or incredibly brilliant. So the key is, as you said, love what you do. And I swear among the 4,900 clients I've had and my friends and colleagues, one of the most important statements that I believe are true is that if you realize that all ethical work is worthy and you throw yourself into it to the same extent you did if you are working for the environment, you will grow to love it, even if it's scrap metal, even if it's working on an assembly line. No, I'm not asking you to breathe carcinogenic crap, but within some fairly broad limits, loving what you do is really the key to being grounded, to being, and coming, bringing us back to full circle here, this segment's supposed to be about getting calmer in social situations, in feeling better about and calmer in those situations, putting yourself in the right work environment, and then that match your skills, and then you're going to be relaxed is key. Push back. I want to give you the last word on this little segment.
Yeah, no, totally. That I think goes into everything, including what we found at John T at Social is, one of the big things, I know you mentioned engineers that may have a hard time socializing, that, you know, not just because of their innate properties, but because of the amount of time spent alone. We always get them saying something like, "Ah, oh, I hate small talk. I think it's such BS to get to where I want to get in my conversation." And the way we push back with that is, you know what, let's find what your favorite kind of small talk is, right? You can, you know, what something we do is we start breaking down conversation and be like, "Well, do you like this? Do you like talking about that? How do we gear the conversation toward that?" And then and it's the same thing like you were talking about, is finding out the stuff you love And then once you're talking about stuff that you love, it comes off when you're engaging with someone.
Listening to Work with Marty Nemko, my guest is Eric Weissman. He runs this thing called jaunty.org to help people who have social anxieties or feel socially inept, including in the workplace, which, of course, is our focus here on the show, helps them to get better. And we're talking about engineers and whatever. Now, the small talk thing. So two thoughts about that. For most engineers, I guess the small talk they feel most comfortable talking about is their work, is the techno things that they like. That's a cliche. Do you think, first of all, is that accurate, and is there anything wrong with that?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I think it depends on your goal. But if you use that as a crutch, you know,
why is that a crutch rather than simply something they like? You know, like, for example, people like to talk about what they like to talk about. And if they're engineers and they like to talk about, you know, the specifications of the latest chip, why is that, you know, bad?
Well, it's not necessarily bad. I think, let's say in a case you're switching careers or switching jobs and you are an engineer. The decision maker you walk up to who can hire you, they've heard it all before. They've basically heard all the technical stuff before, and something that can really differentiate yourself is getting to know them and kind of going, finding out that this is someone I want to sit next to at work, who can not only just, you know, quickly code this in a certain amount of time, but can also brainstorm and come up with ideas that can make the human resources and the relationships at work better.
Let's play that out. Let's make believe you're the boss for that tech company. And I am an engineer. I'm a techie, and I live and breathe for coding and specifications and features and benefits, and I just live for that stuff. And now you're looking to hire, you're now obviously not looking to hire a salesperson or an HR person, but, you know, my essence is I am an engineer. And I come to you, and let's say there's two clones of me. Clone A starts talking tech, says, I just love it. Can you believe the latest version of Visual Basic? It is so cool. You're able to do this algorithm in so many fewer steps, and I just love it, right? And so he goes right to that, and that's a small talk. Clone B says, well, tell me about you. I'd like to a little bit know about what makes you tick. Which are you going to hire? And I noticed even your face cringed, as I said, person B. Who are you really going to hire for that engineer job?
Yeah, if this was someone that you just met, I think a lot of it's how you feel with someone at first. Is this someone inviting? If you're a good manager, you're also going to ask yourself, how is this person going to work with their manager? How is this person going to be able to ask for feedback? Is this person be able to communicate with the people around them? Team building is one of the biggest things. You know, we've trained some really big companies, and this is something that they're focused on, because honestly, it's not hard to find a really good engineer. I mean, we're not talking about the top one percentile, but there's so many engineers out there, and time and time again, we'll hear, wow, it only takes one person to ruin the team as far as not getting along with everyone else. A lot of it is communication. Now, technical skills, of course, you're going to get tested on that in the interview. You're going to have these hard mathematical algorithm questions, and you're going to have to pass that. However, I think a good manager is always looking for someone who's going to make the people around them even better than they are.
I'm always trying to present the other side. I think our listeners benefit from hearing both. When I understand that we live in an era in which team is deified, you know, little cliches like there is no I in team and all of that. But in the end, even in team environments, people end up having to work a lot individually. And in fact, there are many people, you know, if we really celebrate diversity, some people hate teams and they love being given an assignment. Leave me alone. I don't want to have to put up with some worker who's not pulling his or her weight. I don't want to have team decision making, which slows everything down and reduces everything to some tepid thing that everybody can play kumbaya, hold hands, and agree to. I'm staying focused on this engineer because we haven't talked about engineers much on this show, and so that's like a unique thing. If I am the prototypical engineer and I say, I hate teams, I may have to be on one for a while and have to sit in some stupid meetings, but just damn it, give me the software assignment. I'll write my section of the code. And yeah, then I got to present it to the stupid team. what would you say to that person? Is that person being short-sighted? Is that person, are you honoring that person's essence? And let's say he or she feels very uncomfortable in the social, in the Christmas party, the holiday party that is coming up, or at the team meetings where they're supposed to interchange. What advice do you give to the classical engineered in those real-world situations?
Yeah, great question. I think there are people like that, and I think short-term that can work. And I think if they were able to communicate with their boss or with, you know, I'd like to be in a position where I don't have to deal with people, that's definitely possible. But there is a time in the company where you do have to deal with people.
Sure.
And I think that's where things can really stand out, whether you want to get promoted, whether, you know, a lot of engineers do want to become a PM, a product manager, a project manager, and they do want to move up. And that's where a lot of them come to us, and that's where they find that their skills lack. And remember, they're surprised more often than not when they do jump into a company that becomes very social. So if you were in a startup and let's say you were held to yourself and then Google makes you an offer and all of a sudden you get thrown onto the Google campus, they have a really fun social campus. And if you're not able to thrive there and take advantage of the networking and the company culture there and the people that you can meet there, then you're going to have a tough time.
Here I agree with you on both counts. First of all, promotion. When you get away from where you're not going to be sitting and staring at that spreadsheet or that program all day, to rise from that requires much more social skills. And the person who doesn't is generally going to have his or her job offshored. Because there are a zillion programmers, software engineers who can work in China and India and Israel and Ireland and whatever, who work for a fraction of what you do without having the employer having to pay Obamacare and paid family leave and Family Marriage and Leave Act and workers' compensation. And so if you're just another coder and disembodied, not a human being like this robot who just produces, you are at grave risk, especially moving forward. And certainly, yeah, so in promotions and even in your current job as a programmer, you better learn how to do that stuff. And also, it's simply as a human being, it's broadening to not feel you're a machine and to feel like, okay, I can maybe still prefer being alone and I'm being an introvert, but I need to be able to don the mantle of, if not social butterfly, socially acceptable. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, totally. It all ties together. That is a big part, and even outside of work will come into work, right? And so, like, if you have an outside social life that's thriving, you have a wonderful boyfriend or girlfriend, or you're getting along, you have a great support circle of friends, you're going to be a happier person overall, and that's going to come through at work as well. I think I think there's a point where really good technical skills will get you, but your subjective well-being in an overall work environment will make a difference.
I think this is a good time to go to the phones. So, dear listeners, if you are an engineer or know someone who is, or is simply somebody who suffers from social lack of skills, social anxiety, especially with regard to the workplace, because that is the focus of the show, I invite you to call in, and we have an expert on the show. Here is Eric Wiseman. He runs this thing called Jaunty to try to help the socially inept become less so and less stressed in their interactions, and especially around work. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, to ask a question of him. And I usually will throw in my two cents as well, but he will get the first shot. The phone number here at KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before we go to the phones, we are coming up to the holiday parties. You know, this is happening starting now. And so what, if any, specific advice do you have for the person who is shy, engineered or not, anxious, not assertive enough, alcohol prone, whatever it is, pot prone? What not obvious advice do you have for people approaching those office holiday parties?
Great. Yeah, there's a couple things you can do. Something I was thinking about for the holiday parties is, it might sound counterintuitive, but come early. Come early to the party, and I think I think that's going to help, because when you walk in, people are going to be way more sober, for one. And the second thing is, there's going to be less people. And as there's less people, it might feel a little less overwhelming. So if there's maybe four or five people there, it's going to be easier to get to know them one at a time. And what's amazing with that is that as people start walking in, you already know everyone in the party. So you only have one more person to meet, right? And if you really want to be a rock star, you can actually start introducing the people as they stream in to the people you've already met.
Before I go to the phone, we do have calls on the line, but the hardest issue thing is, there's two points. One is coming up to somebody, you said you can be a rock star and introduce people. It's for the engine nerd type, going up saying, hi, you know, I'm Eric Wiseman, is really hard, because you feel like, you know, maybe you're imposing, maybe they don't want you. And then worse, what do you say after hello? What are your thoughts about the insecurity that many engine nerds feel and many people feel about initiating contact with a stranger? And what thoughts do you have about what you say after hello?
Yeah, great question. Everyone's always a little bit scared of after hello. I think something we can start realizing is we have a lot of options in conversation, more than we think we do. And, you know, the main thing is, for instance, if I walked up to you, Marty, at a party and I said, hi, how's it going? And you said, good. Well, now I have a few options.
Let's do it. Let's role play.
Okay.
So we're at a party where we're at the punch bowl, so to speak, or whatever.
Great.
And you're going to now, for whatever reason, you'd come up to me.
Right.
Begin.
So I come up to you, and we're going to freeze frame so we can kind of take a step back and see where things
and
go.
And I'm going to be an engineer. I'm going to be not the most social guy in the world.
Got it. So, hey, Marty, how's it going?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Okay, so let's just take a freeze there. Marty came off a little bit shy, a little uncomfortable.
Right.
So instead of asking him another question, which we usually would do, it'd be like, hey, how's it going? Good? Cool. What'd you do today? Okay, where are you from? Right. What I'd like to do is take some pressure off of you. Right. So if I said, so let's do the same thing where if I say, hey, how's it going? I'm Eric.
Hi, I'm Marty.
Cool. How was your day?
It was fine.
Great, yeah. Speaking of, you know, having a really fine day, I had a really exciting day today.
Now, I'm sitting back and I'm gonna pull. Doesn't that feel pushy? Doesn't that feel like, oh, look, he's this pump it up enthusiastic guy. I said was fine. Oh, great, cool, you had a fine day.
If you were shy, you would love that I'm taking the pressure off you.
Okay.
You would love me going into a little story. What I want to do is let you get your bearings straight.
Okay.
So if you see someone that's a little uncomfortable, and you've given them what we did, closed-ended questions, so they can easily just kind of throw out one or two words if they're uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is actually, and when you take pressure off someone, you don't have to, it's not just with your words, you don't have to be facing them 100%. You can kind of turn a little bit and think about the story you're telling them. What we want to do with someone shy is take pressure off, and as they open up, and if you noticed, I went into a story.
Right.
And something if people have a chance to do is really, really learn the art of storytelling, because naturally, if I was to open up and tell Marty, let's say I went into a vulnerable story where I said something like, hey, Marty, oh, by the way, it was my first time doing a live radio show today. I had a really good day. And, you know, I was a little bit nervous. And now I'm going to make him feel a little more comfortable, mm-hmm. where I'm opening up and being a little more vulnerable. Then he or she will start opening up as you ask. Is you slip in a few open-ended questions.
It is axiomatic. And again, I want to go to the phone, but I can't let this thread drop because it's important. Everybody knows that storytelling is important. Everybody knows, and some people seem really great at it or not. What's a nugget as to how to go from being somebody who is not a born raconteur, a born storyteller, to somebody who can tell a one-minute story? Because you don't want to, you know, we're not going to talk about War and Peace here, but what do you want to teach me and our listeners about the art of telling a one-minute story at an office holiday party, for example?
Yeah, great question. A really quick formula you can do is go through your senses. So if I wanted to tell someone about my experience with Marty, I would be like, well, how did I feel? You know, I was feeling a little bit nervous. And what did that feel like? Well, I had a little bit of butterflies. You know that feeling when you get butterflies. But Marty started making me feel a lot more comfortable. And, you know, it was in this kind of space. And there was all these microphones. Now I can go into visual, right? And then I can talk about how it might have sounded. And then I can talk about, so you can go through, when you start going through your senses, you can it'll remind yourself and it'll extend your story a little bit.
Good tip. Now let's go to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again, though. But if you have a question about social anxiety, especially in the workplace and especially at these upcoming holiday parties, this is a great time to call. We do have calls on the lines, but you won't have to wait too long. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KELW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones, my very special guest. It's really great. My wife happens to be listening.
All right.
And she wants to say something or ask something. Barbara Nemco, what moved you to call?
Well, good morning. This is a topic I care a great deal about because I really am ultimately at my core very shy. Mm. I'm walking into a huge room filled with people, many of whom I don't know. I can be that white-knuckled person standing in the corner, but that doesn't work in the real world. So what I found is, as you know, but your listeners may not, a wonderful book called How to Work a Room by Susan Rowane. It's the ultimate guide to savvy socializing in person and online, but we're talking about in person. And I have used it, I have studied it right in advance of going to a party. And for example, some of the things she does is she gives you ways to break into a group. A group is standing around talking, you'd like to be part of it, you don't know what to do. She gives you a step-by-step how you start on the periphery and you sort of move a little closer and then you laugh when somebody makes a joke and how to get into that group. She gives you opening lines, for example. I don't believe it took me 45 minutes to get here and I only live 3 miles away. Everybody's going to tell you their favorite traffic story, or, oh my God, it never fails. I always manage to get teriyaki sauce on my dress. At least it looks good with the design on it. Or you make a reference to something that you have in common. You're at the event for a purpose. It may be a wedding. So you say, are you from the bride's side or the groom's? Or you're at a charity benefit. How did you get involved with the March of Dimes? Or a political fundraiser? What made you decide to support so-and-so? Have you been involved in the campaign? So she's got chapters and chapters and great suggestions, and I've tried them, and they work.
And Barbara, you have crammed more good advice into a 60-second, you were the 60-second mingling maven, if you will. That was pretty awesome. Do you have anything you'd like to, you don't have to, but do you have a question or comment? No, let me just ask, you know, Eric, do you have any reaction to what she just said?
Yeah, you know, I think all of those are great advice. And I think one of the best things you can do is obviously push yourself to do it and get out there and do it more and more. I would add, you know, focusing on yourself. And one of the biggest pieces of advice we give is to slow down. And once you start slowing down, you can pay a little more attention to the people around you as well. And one of my favorite things to do, and this is a skill that you can actually learn, and you touched on this, Barbara, is use humor, right? Play around with, you know, you mentioned the barbecue sauce or you mentioned, you know, the traffic. It's a little bit funny and people can connect with it. I would, however, be a little bit careful with self-deprecation stuff. So, you know, talking about how clumsy you may be. I love the traffic thing. But as we walk up, I think one of the best ways is to cheers people in these situations. I think, you know, cheersing them and then asking that question as well, that follow-up.
Barbara, you want to react to what he just said?
Well, I mean, I see the point. I tend to use self-deprecating humor. I'm not sure it's hurt me, but yes, it may be a problem for some people. I think what I love about Susan's book is she gives you so many different things that you can do, so many opening lines and ways
That's
to
great.
Continue the conversation. I actually used it once. I had to go to a wedding, and the only person I knew at the wedding, and I was going by myself, was the mother of the groom. Well, I knew she was going to be busy, so I walked into a room of 100% virtual strangers. And I had looked at this book very carefully before I walked in, and one of the things she suggests is look for somebody who's standing by themselves. Walk over and say, hi, how do you relate to this wedding? And then we got into a whole conversation. We became BFFs.
You know, Barbara,
in the space of that one simple question, because she also came to the wedding alone. So it's just a wealth of great things to do. The other thing she says is be pretty up on current events. Read the paper. Read People magazine, so you know a little bit about pop culture. But a current events question is always a good thing to start a conversation.
You know, I recall you saying on the radio a pretty compelling defense of self-deprecating humor. Most people, and tell me if I've got this right, you say that most people deep down have insecurities, and they all want to feel they're equal or better than the next person. And being self-deprecating, I don't mean saying you're a basket case, you're lying in bed with a joint all day, but being self-deprecating by putting yourself down, modesty. Remember, while we are a nation of different religions, we are a largely Christian nation in its culture, which is about modesty, Christian modesty, humility. It's all about, if you are self-deprecating in a moderate way, you are making the other person feel better, and it is consistent with the ethos that exists in America about modesty. And so it's actually quite compelling to me. Did I summarize it accurately? And then I want to hear Eric's pushback, because that was his criticism of you about self-deprecation. Barbara, have I summarized your position well?
Well, yes and no. You need to be careful with it. It's got to be used definitely in moderation, because otherwise you're introducing yourself as, hello, I'm this terrible loser.
Well, that's what I said.
And people are not going to want to get to know you better.
Right. I'm not saying you say you're an axe murderer. Go ahead.
You have to be careful. A little bit goes a long way.
Okay. And, you know, I think maybe this is a good place to end this conversation. Barbara, Eric, did you want to say something? Please.
Yeah, I think Barbara brings up the exact point. Just knowing the difference between being vulnerable and self-deprecating. I think that's where the line is.
Okay. Barbara, I want to thank you very much. Those of you listeners who, you know, listen to the show, Barbara comes on about every 5 weeks. She will be on next on the 20th of this month for part of the show, and I think the whole show on the 27th, something like that. So you will hear more of Barbara Nemco. So, Barb, thanks very much for joining, for calling in.
Thanks, Barbara.
Okay. Let's take, we are out of time for this segment. Or we have one call. We have another call in the line. So let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Eric Weissman, the guy who runs Jaunty, helps people improve their social skills. What is your question or comment for him?
Yes, thank you very much. Before the show sort of went to the party,
so to speak,
we were discussing general relationships at work.
Mm-hmm.
And something that the guest said struck me right away.
Mm.
He said that it's easier for people to have a good relationship with work if they have a good, and then he said, boyfriend or girlfriend. And this is a chance for me and perhaps others to learn about the people who are working in the information technology field that he's referring to. Is it true that most of the people working in those fields do not have families, that they're at the girlfriend and boyfriend stage rather than having the kinds of involvements that are involve families when they have children?
Eric?
Great question. And I think, that does tie back to kind of your outside life and happiness, bringing that into work. And unfortunately, I think some bigger companies target that. Right, to target someone who may not have family, who may not have a relationship that can keep them away from work. And so, I don't know what the numbers are, but what we see when people come to us is they're single, and I think that does affect their happiness rate, because they're getting paid well in some cases when they're engineers, and they feel like they've been pretty accomplished. However, they feel like that there's that emptiness of not having a significant other, and I think that can definitely make them feel a little bit down on themselves at work, which can affect their work. And so the good news is I think you can work on yourself to find that special person using social skills and at holiday parties and going out rather than online. And that's one of the biggest problems, is that they're trying to find that online, and and dating online is something that is okay in the sense that you can meet people that you never would have had a chance to meet. However, it's much more effective meeting people face-to-face and knowing that you can do that.
Caller, what's your reaction to his notion? It felt pretty broad brush to me that, you know, everybody needs relationships in order to enhance their work life as well as personally. Do you believe it should be as broad brush as that, or is there room for the person who is not very relational? What is your honest reaction to Eric's comment?
I'm really trying to learn, because this kind of engineering, when I think of engineering, I think of someone who builds a bridge, but obviously that isn't anymore what it is. And I was just trying to learn more about the nature of the relationships that people in this, you'd call it, new technology field, the nature of what their personal relationships are. I have no knowledge about it at all.
Okay. Well, I thank you as usual for your call. Appreciate it very much. Eric, I want to ask you one more kind of a softball question, open-ended question. You know, think back on this interview. Think of the one thing that maybe you haven't said that you would be of particular interest to the person who's got social anxiety, especially in the workplace, and maybe even especially as we approach the holiday parties, the office parties now.
Yeah, I think the number one thing other than slow down is play. I think when we get nervous, the last thing we think about is throwing a joke out there. We feel like it's going to make, if it falls flat, it's going to become worse. I think if there's one wedge people can put in their brain is you're going to a holiday party to have fun. Everyone's there to have fun. And I think if you don't have the mindset of, hey, if I see something that's kind of fun or playful or funny in my environment, and you know, when you walk into those holiday parties, pay attention to the environment. You know, someone spent a lot of time probably decorating, and you can play with the environment. You can play with the scene, and don't be afraid to kind of tease with it. And it'll make you start feeling better as you start smiling and laughing, and other people will start feeling more comfortable. We feel like we hold back with new people with humor. I always get I have to get to know them before I mess with them a little bit in some way. But it's kind of, I want you to think counterintuitively to where it's okay to start off with some playfulness and humor.
I want to ask one follow-up question. Obviously, we all vary on many continuum, from height and weight to intelligence, and also humor. There seems to be some people who find it very easy to be playful, to find the humor in something. They're quick on their feet. We call them, they used to term used to be hail fellow well met, you know, those kind of people. But we're talking here about helping people for whom it doesn't come easily. What's one tip you would have for somebody who's serious by nature, who doesn't come up with humor and jokes on the fly? They're not going to be that person. Do you have a tip for that person?
Yeah, believe it or not, you can make humor technical while you're learning it, right? And like you can take a lot of different styles of humor. There's a ton of different styles of humor. But something you can do very quickly is think of sarcasm, and in a positive way, right? And you can think of irony. And one of the first things you can start doing, as I mentioned, is you look at your environment, start thinking of opposites. You can start playing with opposites. This is just an example of a formula. So, for instance, Marty, if we walk outside and we open the door and it's raining cats and dogs, you can look at me with a straight face and say the opposite, which is,
it's sunny. Isn't it so beautiful out here today?
It's a beautiful day. This is great. And for the witty, if you want to get witty, right, how can you make something like that indirect? And, for instance, you think of the opposite, but then what would you do on a sunny day? So you can turn to me and say something like, you brought your sunscreen, right? Or you have your picnic basket, let's go to the beach. Where I actually have to think about one level further of what you were saying. Does that make sense?
Well, hopefully our listeners have thought one level further about their social skills. And Eric Weisman, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. His website is jaunty.org. They do a bunch of workshops and things and meetups and all that kind of stuff. So you can learn about that if you want to try to, as they say, take your social skills to the next level. The jaunty.org, jaunty.org. Again, Eric Weisman, thanks for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
Good. That's great. So now we turn to you, my dear listeners. We do now what I really prioritize in the show, which are called workovers. If you or someone you care about is stuck, In your work life. I don't care if you're unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, if you're self-employed or working for government or corporation, small company, whatever, 16 or 76. The one thing we can be sure is that the price is right. Zero, zippo, nada, and I can usually help. All you need to do is call, and this is the best time to call because what always happens is the lines get filled up and then you end up sitting on hold for 10 or 15 minutes and the show's over. So, tip from Marty Wise Nemko. This is the time to call. The phone number here, work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I want, while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, this is the time when people are planning their holiday vacations. What are we going to do during, you know, we're going to take a break. We'll finally get some time off. What are we going to do? Well, I, frankly, this is an essay I wrote for The Atlantic, and it's short enough that I thought I would read it to you. And it's called The Case for Staycations, subtitle, Why Vacations Are Overrated. Sure, if you're dating, a staycation can't compete with 7 days, 6 nights in Hawaii. But otherwise, I wonder if people who tout vacations suffer from selective memory. I can't blame them. Corporations spend fortunes on vacation commercials, trying to get you to part with $6,000, which is the average cost for two for a biplane vacation, including the 20% tax on hotels, on airfares, on rent-a-cars, and so on. Everyone in such commercials appear pre-orgasmic, gaping at some native dance, in awe of some famous monument, or cavorting in surreal water with a model. Those amnesiacs forget that to prepare for a vacation, you not only need to take hours to pack and buy stuff like a 220-volt converter, you have to cram in on top of your already busy life all the work that needs to be done in your absence. Get that report done. Visit those customers. See your ailing relative. You have to make arrangements for the dog. Get somebody to water the plants. And if you have kids, bringing them is a pain. Finding someone to stay with them is a pain, sometimes an expensive pain. Despite taking hours to pack, you usually leave something home. Maybe it's just that sun hat to ward off the beach sun you're flying thousands of miles to bask in. No big deal. It's hard to pack anyway. But what if it's your medication, precipitating a postponement of that first day on the beach while you scramble to find some pharmacist willing to sell you some? Then there's the getting to and fro. With flight cutbacks, chances are good you'll be flying at god-awful times and for a long time. And don't forget about having to leave extra early so you don't miss the plane, even if there is traffic, to allow time for parking, the shuttle, the airport security, sitting in the terminal or the tarmac, or an even longer stint if yours is one of the 25% of flights that get delayed. Take a two-leg flight and you can count on your round trip containing a delay. And then you're cooped up in that stale air, cramped airplane for hours. And let's hope you're not sitting next to that obese person you can't even fit in, or that person who's coughing, or that nonstop crying baby. And then there's that great food they're no longer serving, so you have to take the time to pack and schlep food or buy overpriced victuals at the airport or on the plane. Then, as you're taking the overpriced cab ride to your hotel, and hopefully he didn't take you the circuitous route, you're praying your hotel room looks even vaguely like the JPEG on the hotel's website. Are we having fun yet? Yes. And then you have your days of experience a new culture, with language barriers which make your life crazy, and being one with history, as you stare at historic churches, artifacts, and buildings, complete with guided tour. King Kamehameha lived in this building from 1752 to 1759. Or you bake yourself on that skin cancer-causing beach, assuming it's not raining. Alas, not much sooner than you finally unwound, it's time to reverse the process. On the way home, you're mulling the opportunity cost, what you could have done with a $6,000. And at last, you return home. Now, remember now, aren't you usually relieved to finally get home? You pay the dog sitter and or the babysitter, and you thank the neighbor for watering your plants and taking in the newspapers. And then you return to work, to find the inevitable avalanche of email, voicemail, and snail mail, not to mention the actual work that piled up in your absence. You need a vacation, or rather, a staycation. Give me 7 one-day staycations over 1 7-day vacation any time. Think of all the things you enjoy to do, but perhaps rarely get to do, and you can do them without the travel hassle and the cost. If we can push aside the inflated perceptions of traditional vacations wonders and stop suppressing the negatives that have beset you on your past treks, many people will decide to replace their 7-day vacation with 7 one-day staycations. How about you? My wife Barbara's reaction? Those are all good points, but take me to Hawaii. Anyway, that's my little pre-holiday vacation little essay. But now we go to our serious priority, which is you. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work problem, you can call in for a work over. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
My name is Chris, and I'm sorry, there's some background noise where I am. There's a fire truck going past.
No problem.
I want to start by thanking you for some essential advice that really helped me to succeed in a recent job interview.
Great. What was it? What was the one piece of advice you want to share with our listeners so that others can benefit?
You know, my broad takeaway was you've got to be willing to hold up the mirror and see in yourself the flaws that only you can correct.
And what was, if you can share with us one flaw that you, when you held up the mirror to you, what did you realize and how did that end up getting brought up or not in the interview process?
I can be, I don't know if aggressive is the word. I'm very high energy. I'm very outgoing. Mm-hmm. And I need to be more of a listener and a follower.
And did you mention that in the, if anything, did you say about that in the interview process?
You know, the only thing that comes immediately to mind, and it just, it totally must have resonated with the interviewer, because I kind of characterize myself as the uncarved block. And it turns out she has a real Buddhist psychology. So I think that is probably something helpful that I've done.
Metaphors are very good. I'm really a fan of, you know, I've had 4,900 career counseling clients, and one of the things that I've come to learn that I didn't believe when I started is that it is very hard to fundamentally change people. And in the interview process, it is better to speak your truth about your limitations. So if I were interviewing for a job and I was very outgoing, and I wouldn't say I need to dial myself back. I'd probably say I'm a very outgoing person, a very high-energy person, and if your work culture is going to require a great deal of restraint, maybe I'm not the right person for the job. But we're here on a first date, essentially on this job interview, and I just want to see if we're a fit. If you say that, you're going to add credibility, and you're going to get rejected from the wrong jobs and more likely to be accepted for the right one. What's your reaction to that?
Oh, I agree completely, because I interview really well, and I have interviewed myself into some jobs that I had no business being in. But this was actually a second interview, and it was just to see if I was a fit with my clinical supervisor.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, you called. Did you call just to share that, which is fine, but did you call with a question? Is there any way I can be of help to you right now?
Well, yeah, because I know that you write for Psychology Today and that you know, are in the profession of psychology in a number of ways. And so now that I have clinical experience in a number of areas and I'm positioning myself to start looking for a career-level position, the area in which I have determined I really want to work is preventing children from winding up in foster care and or the criminal justice system.
Great. Okay. And so what is your question for me? Be a little more specific and I'll take it from there.
Who am I looking to work for? Who is doing that work?
One of three places: Child Protective Services, adoption, or foster care. There are tons of government agencies especially that are devoted specifically to that, and it is my belief that You know, I always like to look first at the 30,000-foot level. I believe that Hillary Clinton will be the next president and that we will have a fully Democratic Congress and that California, and where much of the funding is going to continue to be dominated both in the Assembly and the House by Democrats. And that means that there's going to be better funding for those agencies. And that is where the, in my judgment, the last bastion, last large bastion for secure, benefited, not part-time, not temp, not offshoreable jobs will exist. So it seems to me that what you need to do is you need to start reaching out to those agencies that are in a geographic area that is comfortable for you where you'd like to live. And remember that even if it's a government job and they make it appear as like it's a highly rational process where you score 93 on this exam, that's BS. The reality is that it is, in fact, as just like in the private sector, it is as much who you know as what you know. So if you systematically made a list of all those agencies, identified a person who is the power to hire you or somebody close to it, and reached out and asked for advice, either by email or phone, and say, I have really done a lot of thinking about what I want to do, and it seems like the right fit for me is to be helping kids end up in the system. What is there any kind of preventive roles, not so much curative after the fact roles, that I might serve? And one more point, if you want to get in earlier in the cycle than that, then you're dealing in the world of education. You know, might you want to be a school-based counselor? Some of those jobs are hard to get, but you may also, if you live, for example, in San Francisco, you may want to contact either the head of psychological services, because there's tons of school psychology jobs that are likely to become, because a lot of them are about to retire, school counselor jobs, speaking to people who are in the local school district, somewhere among those. And you shouldn't make the mistake of getting too specific too fast. You should identify 5 to 10 people in those various different entities. And it could also be a nonprofit. There are, you know, I know the San Francisco Ed Fund does a lot of stuff like this. There are all kinds of nonprofits. Make your goal 10 organizations. I don't think in your case we're talking for-profits, but in the nonprofit or governmental space, and treat each of them like a seed, where you're planting the seed and watering and feeding it over a period of weeks or months in hopes that one will sprout into a good job, so that when a job does get posted and advertised, you will then, instead of being one of the horde coming in from the outside anonymously, you will at least have built some foundation of a relationship. What do you like and not like about that prescription?
I love it, and you read my mind. I was going to ask what your thoughts were about working in the nonprofit sector, and I actually have already begun building the network. I'm just coming right now this very morning from a meeting with Episcopal Ministries, who does a lot of work in the communities that I'm interested in working with.
If you're my client, though, I am, you know, nonprofits are always trying to get by on volunteers and $10 an hour people, and there isn't job security. That's why I immediately went to the government first. Whether it be those agencies, as I said, in adoption or whatever, but also the schools, you know, that, in the end, most people don't like the freelance society. There are some people who are the real high-powered go-getters who just love the idea of going from project to project, but most people like the security of infrastructure, of co-workers, of stability, of not worrying you're going to get axed the next minute. So I would encourage you, if you are one of those kind of people, to think that way. How do you honestly react to that?
Well, my career to date has been in the arts and in education. My undergrad is fine art, my master's degree is education. So I have spent my entire career thus far in the nonprofit sector, and I am very aware of the perils of which you speak.
Right.
But I think I also know how to navigate that.
Good.
And I have learned to sacrifice or prioritize living simply
in
an environment where I can be creative, as opposed to like working for the San Francisco Unified School District and having to navigate their bureaucracy.
There's nothing like living simply to give you degrees of freedom. If you're not tied to material spending and you live in modest housing, which is the number one way to reduce your costs, that affords you many more options than you otherwise could have. So I certainly embrace that. But because you have your master's in education, if you're trying, and again, maybe I'm just being incessantly practical here, I'd rather see you springboard off of that. So even though your criticizing the bureaucracy and the perhaps lack of flexibility that might accrue in working with the San Francisco Unified School District. It doesn't have to be. San Francisco is one of the biggest, and therefore, you know, and again, it tends to be very bureaucratic for a variety of reasons that will go beyond the scope of this discussion. But there are smaller school districts or even private schools. A lot of Christian schools are focused on vulnerable populations, not the fancy prep schools, but if you're interested in preventing kids from getting into, you know, the legal system and criminal justice system and the rest of it, maybe you might take a look at the world of, since you have an education background, the Catholic schools, the Christian schools, etc., that may serve that population, and being a counselor there might be a nice middle ground so that you're not just abandoning your education master's degree. What's your reaction to that?
Yes, that is resonating with me. I'm a little torn, but I'm processing through this.
Sure.
As kind of allergic as I am to bureaucracy,
right.
My real passion is for policy reform.
I think that's I'm going to interrupt you because we're coming to running out of time here. That's a trap. Everybody likes policy. It's fun to come up with big ideas to change the world because we all are idealistic. We all want to make a difference. But the number of people who end up making substantive policy is trivial. And just coming in, you know, you've got your arts background and your education background, and now you've got some psychology training. The odds of you making significant policy are pretty small. So I would encourage you to resist that trap and to use the bumper sticker redder, think globally but act locally. Find some way in which you are in you're stopping the fire truck. No, you are working at your local level with individuals, with groups, with parents, and perhaps with, you know, thinking globally. Do some writing if you're a writer. Do some blogging if you're more a visual person. Create YouTube videos, you know. But I tend to be incessantly practical, especially since you sound like you've had a number of years of background. You're not like starting out. You don't have a degree in public policy from Stanford. So I'm encouraging you to think about policy in a more micro than macro level. You can push back. What's your honest reaction to that?
No, that resonates with me as well, because I have worked for local level pilot programs that then did go national.
Great.
And affected.
I like it.
You start out locally, you run it up the local flagpole, and if somebody salutes it, then it's going to get the attention that, you know, broadens it to affect policy in a more comprehensive way.
I like it. And on that point of agreement, I want to thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Great caller. Feel free to call back with Progress Report. We love hearing progress reports around here.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank again Eric Wiseman, who is my guest. Jaunty.org, I know that he put on a lot of these meetups, and I think that's great social networking, it's great personal networking, and you're going to learn some skills. So I would encourage you to go to Jaunty.org and see what he's got coming up. Anyway, I also want to thank my board operator, Joy Onmar, who I always appreciate. She's so professional, and I like to keep pointing it out, because not everybody is. So tip of the cap, as usual, to Joanne. And, of course, for all of you for listening and calling in, please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will devote the entire hour to call-in workovers, and I will intersperse my favorite new career tips. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.